Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Third episode of Phenomenal Physics. I'm just reading basically a children's sort of library book, library book bought up at a school fete. I bought it, I think, for basically 10 cents. Phenomenal Physics, a totally non-scary guide to physics and why it matters. You know, like a totally non-scary, it's sort of like getting in there. The agenda here. Now, they're making... if you want an example of what's wrong with school physics, they're making mistake after predictable mistake, just walking right into it. So at the area that's sort of lack of understanding of saying, you know, how can there be two focuses in an elliptical orbit? Well, the second focus has actually got a mass on it, and that's the mass of the rest of the... It's just complete gibberoo. And then these very paintbrush sort of cartoon views of various people in history, and up to René Descartes. Now, there are a few people which, for some reason, I sort of relate to in a way that, you know, I think the Australian word is a wanker. If you're a wanker or you're a bit of a bully, I just can't get over it. So some of the people who I think are superheroes, super sort of all the nice right through, you cut them and they're completely nice through, would be Boltzmann. Love him. Ludwig Boltzmann. He's just someone who had personal flaws and problems, and he had his personal problems inside himself, and so people were attacking him so much he didn't have the personal flaws there. James Clerk Maxwell was a really nice person. Faraday, a lovable person, absolutely, truly lovable, conflicted person with strokes and all this type of stuff. Going back to ancient history, I sort of Parmenides I do like, because he just sort of struggled and somehow wrote a poem, you know, and the idea, sort of the understanding of poetry and plays being the origin, like him. Philo, I also like him because he's wants to be a Jewish scholar, but he's really a Greek, and he's in there doing things. So there's some of the philosophers I really, really like. Newton, I think, is a bit hollow for me, a bit of a wanker. Hooke. Who stood by him, I sort of I feel sympathetic for, I don't go, oh, you know, mate. Now, René Descartes was sort of someone who actually stepped ahead of his world and was a true, absolute Renaissance person and was able to hold so much thought. The brain thing, you're limited in the amount of thoughts you can do, and you sort of sit back and say, how much thought can these bloody people do? They didn't have a computer, word processors, they didn't have files and notes, they just had all in their head. Now, they didn't have a lot of distractions, so I think they didn't have TV and multimedia, so that may be things. He rented a car. What I liked about him is he sort of had an eloquent speaking, which you don't see in other philosophers. It's sort of an eloquence. I was trying to think of there's a French person, I cannot think of his name. I'm just really trying to think. He set up a chateau in Switzerland. The name escapes my head. I know who he is. I'll look him up. I'll get him and I'll go, aha. So René Descartes had this beautiful way of speaking. This other French philosopher, I'm really trying to think, he wrote plays, he's French. He sort of came back after a son of the revolution, real critique of the upper class, married a famous French scientist, Voltaire. Bloody hell, Voltaire. Personal life. Voltaire is someone who really does it. Descartes is another person who does it for me. I still don't have expectations of philosophers to know things beyond their time, but Descartes, I still can sympathise because he had the view that he really reasoned the God, but he said, in reasoning, there is actually no God. There's got to be a continuous chain of reasoning. Now, with that reasoning, he has come up with a lot of the spirit of modern science. Newton was able to have gaps in his theory where he just placed God, and Descartes did it as well, in different sort of on a different level. He sort of went into the mind matter, mind over matter. I think, therefore, I am that aspect. And so, his thinking of God led him to put God away the place. I don't know if you can hear the bloody Australian flies going around my face. Fortunately, I've got some glasses on. Being a bit older, an older chap here, I'll scare the living daylights out of here. If any kid comes along, they'll go, oh, bloody oath, there's a weirdo doing it. Okay, René Descartes is remembered today for his achievements in various fields. I would say René Descartes is not remembered today, and very few people know anything about him, is my view. From pure sciences and mathematics to the most abstract philosophy, well, there's some mathematics, pure science didn't really amount to much. Although a contemporary of Galileo, Descartes was not so singularly focused on performing experiments and developing concrete scientific theories. Yeah, because he still had this religious, you know, bucking out from scholasticism. It's sort of like a medieval belief of, you know, basic thinking. Now, this is the rationalists. And it's all very, very interesting, the rationalists. You've got Immanuel Kant, I think Schopenhauer, Einstein, these people who use rationalism to create a superstructure to go down in. And he produced a superstructure, unfortunately, didn't go down. His focus was on determining precisely how one should endeavour to think about things in the first place, which is i.e. the method. So here's this level of abstraction of what am I thinking about, or no, I'm going to actually go upskill myself and look at how I think the method. So this is truly revolutionary. I'm going to think, how am I thinking about God? What's truth? And he comes up with things which ultimately sort of are bound by a few assumptions about God. And therefore, he believes that something is true if it's got a real look and feel of truth, which is quite a practical view. He thought and wrote about logic, about method, about how one might finally come to understand the universe in full, which is just, you know, this is sort of like someone who was, you know, sort of going along, and as everyone sort of commenting, say there's a building burning, everyone's saying, oh, the first floor or something, I was safe. And then someone comes along and saying, you know, throughout history, you've built buildings out of combustible materials, giving a general gist that you come away with a great feeling. I really loved it. Okay, Descartes was born in 1596. So this is, you know, Shakespeare died in 1605. You know, I think Queen Elizabeth died, you know, so he's around there. But you've got to understand how much more sophisticated the French were than the English. It's amazing. He educated at the Jesuit College of La Flèche in Anjou, France. He entered college at only 8 years old, which everyone did, studying the basic and mostly unquestioned tenets of Aristotelian philosophy and essential mathematics. And essentially he was taught by idiots, and he described it a parody of logic, but it's not anything. From a young age, Descartes suffered from poor health, and from this he developed the lifelong habit of remaining in bed each day until late morning. Yeah. After graduating from La Flèche in 1612, Descartes travelled relentlessly throughout Europe. He gained a law degree and attended military school and studied mathematics extensively. by 1628, weary of travelling, he settled in Holland, where he wrote with his, well, obviously with the French army there, his physics treatise. This is like he wasn't, the important thing is that he wasn't attached to a nobleman. He actually didn't have to spend half his time. He was a full-time philosopher. That, you know, whereas other people, you know, this is strange. So he wasn't attached to a university. He was, but he was able to actually pull himself off and say, well, I'm not going to be a commercial object. He gained a law degree and attended military school and studied mathematics extensively. Okay. In his book, he states that matter is made up of a tiny corpuscle, a precursor of the modern atomic theory, and describes the universe in which the Earth moves around the Sun. Which obviously is stuff where he sort of made a high level commentary of the church and realized at a high level that he wasn't going to go that way. And I think I said, talked about sort of understanding thinking areas in terms of candles. This is not directly engaging it, but looking at the overall style and the likely behavior associated with it. It's really interesting to see how he wrote about it. However, when he heard of Galileo's trouble in Italy, he decided not to publish his work. Mm-hmm. Descartes tackled deep philosophical questions about the truth of nature and humanity from a purely logical perspective, which is his irrationalist. He also set out about devising a comprehensive plan for combining science and mathematics to reduce a more objective framework for the development of human knowledge, which Francis Bacon is at the same stage. He's not going to do it. Francis Bacon nailed it. He was, they're all doing things. Although he did not deny the basic tenets of religion, Descartes believed pure sciences and reasons were all that one needed in order to understand the full workings of the universe, which is sort of Newton's view. But Newton was saying that science and it just like the superstructure, and underneath it is God, whereas Descartes went the whole way. His monumental discourse on method, I love that, published in 1837, Descartes began with simple principles and taught his readers how best to think about science, first by questioning everything, removing all bias. Now, the bias, beautiful bias, is he's written in such a good way. Francis Bacon wrote out the same thing, the idols. The idols of sources of bias going across here. And then, building up a theory based on sound observation, Descartes also used his work to invent one of the most common tools in mathematics, the Cartesian coordinate system. Well, yeah, of course, it's pretty amazing. Descartes moved into more abstract philosophical territory. And you've got to understand that Kepler and everyone was operating without Cartesian coordinates. They were just amazing. Philosophy in the Meditations on First Philosophy, was he offered the famous explanation for how one might know they exist. I think, therefore, I am. That makes me die. Descartes died of pneumonia in Stockholm in 1650. Queen Christina of Sweden had persuaded him to move there in order to become his personal tutor, and she was an early riser. Now, she was sort of a super Catholic superhero of things. So the scientific method, I hope you are not going to, gee whiz, I'm just going to go through this during the Renaissance. What irks me is the fact that it doesn't use the word induction here, and it doesn't use Francis Bacon. During the Renaissance, European scholars were responsible for advancing human understandings on theories such as motion, gravitation, optics, as well as forging new grounds in areas such as mathematical physics. Perhaps the single most important of these, however, was the development of a clear, concise, consistent scientific method, a system by which observation and reasons were employed in order to test more rigorously the theories of the universe. Here's the steps, the five steps. And I think this is if I've ever seen it. Although there's no single defined series of steps in which every scientist conducts research, there's at least a generally agreed method which constitutes good practice. It tends to go like this. Oh dear. Make an observation of the universe. For example, hikers walking through the forest spots two black bears. Describe this observation and use this to develop a general rule. So this is the law of induction, which is Locke So this is the law of universality thing, called hypothesis. That is consistent with observation. Those bears are black, so all bears must be black, which is deductive. Deductive things, all bears are black, so those bears are black, those bears are black, and so all bears are black. It's reverse deduction. Use the hypothesis to make predictions about future experiments. The hiker predicts that she sees another bear, it will be also black, as will the bear following that one. Test those predictions by performing experiments and making further observations. Be prepared to modify the hypothesis in the light of the latest results. The hiker sees the next bear is brown. She amends the hypothesis to include brown bears as well as black bears. Repeat the pattern of observation and repellent the hypothesis. There are no longer any discrepancies. The hiker travels all over the road. As soon as she found a black, brown bears, white bears, black and white bears, grey bears, and bears of a few other colours. Eventually, she expanded her hypothesis to include every bear she could find on Earth. The greater the number of accurate observations, the more accurate the hypothesis. This is the foundation of scientific method. So, it is basically, the scientific method is disproving a guess. So you make a series of guesses which are not disproven, essentially, and that's it. Finding the truth. There is no real last step to this basic scientific method, unfortunately. The nature of science is such that these steps must be repeated endlessly, and the truth is that science, one can really never take the final steps and declare something as fact. Oh, bullshit. Surely that's in one area, but then when rationalism, this is something which works as akin to rationalism. So we can actually sort of define the speed of light as a fact. A theory may only be as complete as the experimentation that's used to develop it. That's when we say something like the force of gravity is felt between any two objects in the universe. We have only a theory. We have it as only a theory, generalized. However, you've got, this is important, so there's some gravity waves and stuff like that. Occam's razor, which is just guff as far as I'm concerned. Occam's razor is a logical principle attributed to the 14th century friar William of Ockham. It has become a hallmark of scientific theories ever since. It's a scientific explanation theory, and it's a way of actually winnowing out hard to understand explanations, but for God's sake. Ockham stated that entities should not be multiplied unnecessarily. This has been taken to mean that whenever two or more explanations are given for a phenomenon, the simpler one is generally preferable. In other words, the scientists use Ockham's razor to cut away any superfluous elements of a theory, preferring to leave the simplest explanation necessary. Logic dictates that the simpler the answer tends to be preferable to an overly complicated one. This little rule is useful as any logical situation, even outside the realm of science. Predictions based on what we have so far observed about the universe. Perhaps one day we might find that somewhere in a distant galaxy there are objects which do not obey the law of gravity. If we did, we would recognize that our theory was incomplete and we'd have to fix it. Well, yeah, this is the problem that we can actually observe the entire universe. We can get, say, a law of thermodynamics, is a statement here. Okay, the birth of modern physics and Sir Isaac Newton. I just will just get so upset reading this. Okay, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll get this one off.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.